I'd like to welcome you here to the Women on Wednesday series, Still Fighting for Your Rights 30 Years Later. A few housekeeping items before we get started. Please turn off cell phones and pagers, and please stay in your seats until 12:50. Also, if you could please fill out the evaluation sheet, as we do use this information for future programming, and please stop by the back table for future programming information. The International Affairs Plank on the National Plan of Action outlined the tremendous gaps and dismal record of involving women at all levels of international affairs, including foreign policy, women in development, human rights treaties, international conventions on women, peace and disarmament, and education. This presentation will draw upon the unique experiences of our presenters, who will offer a framework, examples, and analysis on the role of women internationally. Excuse me. Dr. Mumbi Mwangi is an assistant professor in the Women's Studies program at SESU. She received her bachelor's and master's degrees in education from Kenyatta University, Kenya, and later obtained her PhD in education with a minor in Women's Studies from Iowa State University. Her scholarly and research interests include curriculum and pedagogy, international education, feminist methodology, qualitative methodology, women in education, international, transnational motherhood, and global issues affecting women, particularly in the third world. Dr. Swethina Mboko is a visiting professor from the University of Zimbabwe. Here at SESU, she is teaching international business management, women in business, and gender and globalization. Dr. Mboko received her Bachelor of Commerce degree from the University of South Africa, MBA from the University of Zimbabwe, and her PhD in Strategy and Female Entrepreneurship, which was jointly awarded by the University of Zimbabwe and Umeå University of Sweden. Her scholarly and research interests include strategy, women in business, and entrepreneurship. We are very grateful to have them with us today. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Dr. Mumbi Mwangi and Dr. Swethina Mboko.
Good afternoon. Hello, how are you? Well, you have already been told I'm Swethina Mboko from Zimbabwe. I came to the U.S. last year in July, so this is my first winter here. I've been in winter before. At home, we don't have winter like you have it here. But for 3 years, I went through a similar winter, but I think Swedish winter is more friendly than yours. Lots of snow, but no breezy weather. Anyway, I'm very pleased to be here, and I hope in the little time we've been given, I will be able to share with you some perspectives. I'm really not going to give a lecture. In my short experience here, I've noticed there's a lot I could talk about what goes on at home. There are issues that we take for granted in Africa. There are issues that you take for granted here. And when you have traveled and you have worked with various people, you probably see that even what you consider to be basic could really be something different for somebody who has not experienced it. So to a large extent, I'm just going to talk about my experiences working with women in business. So my approach will emphasize the role of entrepreneurship in development. I'm from a business background. So when I look at development, I'm particularly interested in the development that could come from businesses. And if I look at entrepreneurship, the way it is defined, it really is an engine of economic growth, but it is very individualistic in approach. As an individual, if you are going to start your own business, you identify an opportunity, you think about it, you do whatever it takes to pursue that opportunity until it gives you results. And I've been observing developments in relation to assisting poor women improve their situation. And one approach acknowledges the role of business in development. Sadly for me, development efforts to improve the situation of women in Africa have assumed we can go the collective route in developing businesses. I mean, there are various development models. We can develop through, you know, perhaps general literacy, and that is really acknowledged. We can develop in different ways. But if we choose to use a business model, I think it is our responsibility and the responsibility of those involved in assisting business people to develop a general working knowledge of what it takes to go into business. Because that way you come up with assistance that is going to bring more honorable results. So I'm just going to share with you a few images that we have seen, you know, framing assistance given to business women in Africa. Perhaps we are in the way of the images. We just see a few. There are just a few images. I'll talk through them. Can I use this one? All right. Now, when we look at development of African women from a business perspective, the assumption that we have worked with, and that assumption has a basis, we don't have enough resources in Africa. And when people, you know, visualize the African woman that they are going to assist, in a lot of cases, this is somebody who is really poor, somebody who has a lot of work to do at home, somebody who perhaps does not have many years of education. And if they are going to go into business, perhaps somebody would have brought it up to them. So to a large extent, we don't see African women as women highly motivated for business ownership. So the approach that has resulted from that is really to bring these women together, try to assist them in the form of income-generating projects, perhaps give them basic training in perhaps you bake bread or what else can we do, Mumbi, in groups?
Make things to sell.
Make things to sell. And usually in the local community, and this is a poor community that you are selling to, and that takes a lot of time because, you know, working as a group requires leadership skills. Somebody needs to mobilize resources. So these women are not going to be alleviated of their normal chores. In addition to their normal household chores, they need to organize themselves into income-generating projects, come up with items that they can sell to the local community, and this is a poor community, and we are looking at sustainable livelihoods. You are going to make a living from whatever you are going to earn from that community. And if we raise it, we go to the informal sector where, you know, each one is working on their own. But again, this is really not the formalized type of, you know, business. But the informal sector has a critical role. Income generating projects have a critical role. The informal sector has a critical role. But we also find there are some women who have decided to go formal. And it is these women that I'm talking about, that in addition to the various development efforts that we are, you know, giving, can we work with these outstanding women? Can we learn something from them? Can we incorporate entrepreneurship concepts into our development efforts? And then come up with models that will probably help assist, you know, the contribution of women to development through entrepreneurship. So what I want to do now is perhaps just to say a few words about the way I see entrepreneurship in the context of the African woman. Do we still have any? I mean, those images are just showing Divine's, you know, a business, just portraits from her business in terms of what she has managed to do, and I'll take time to try to explain why, to me, we can learn a lot from the few women entrepreneurs who would have made it in business. So, Mumbi, we can go back to the panel. Perhaps what I'll just do is to explain my understanding of entrepreneurship and frame it in the context of developing African women. Now, the fact that there are some African women who have started sustainable businesses needs to be recognized. But if we look at their numbers, they are really in the minority in relation to, you know, perhaps other activities taking place. But what I want to mention is, you know, entrepreneurship is a very rare attribute. It is not a common attribute at all. If we look at large businesses, even in the developing world, very few people started those businesses. But these businesses have been supported to a point that the nation shakes if they hear that this particular organization is going to close, because they know the economic impact of one large organization closing. Now, with income-generating projects, if one project fails, well, a bunch of women are going to be disappointed. Their source of livelihood would have gone. But in terms of the recognition that they are going to get, because of the almost insignificant impact they were having on the total economy, is not that huge. So my appeal when I talk about entrepreneurship development is, when we are talking to grassroots women, one option is to give them information about what business is, about what it takes to go into business, about fighting the stereotypes about, you know, what it means to be a businesswoman. Because in our part of the world, being a businesswoman is not something that is looked at positively. And if we saw the comments that were coming from the one example we have picked of a woman who went into the security industry in Zimbabwe at a time when it's really risky living in Zimbabwe, we can learn a lot about what it takes to break the stereotypes. And I think I'll leave it to Mumbi to try to see how we can incorporate whatever development efforts we are making into empowering these women so that at least they bring meaningful development to Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mboko, for that presentation, and thank you all for coming. My name is Mumbi Mwangi, and I am going to focus on the process of democratization and the grassroots movements in Kenya. Now, when you think about grassroots movements, we are talking about the rural women, and I think most of you have seen the rural women that Boko has kind of given us the images. So we are talking about grassroots, we are talking about those organizations at the grassroots level, at the village level. At the same time also, I want you to put, and I don't know whether those people there can be able to put the images up there, but I also want you to imagine, you know, how life in Africa, and especially in the rural Africa, is. So we are talking about women who are not, most of them uneducated. We are talking about women who don't have the actual access to resources. We are talking about women who also experience culture in a very, very traditional way. And we are talking about women also who are burdened, you know, by many, many kind of chores that they are responsible for in terms of how the society defines motherhood and womanhood. So I think I'll just let it run, you know, because these are some of the images that I want you to see, and they don't have to have music or anything, and when it's done, we are all done. But I want you to just kind of look at what the images of women, so that we know the kind of context through which we are talking about. So my paper, again, is going to talk about the important role of women in Kenya. And when I talk about Kenya also, I also imagine that it's the same kind of context and experiences for women, even in Africa generally, and also in most of the third world countries. I'm going to focus on highlighting women's actions in both collective and individual levels in terms of their access and participation to, as far as political is concerned. There are many indications that women have successfully created new avenues of expression and spaces for themselves within the context of changing political realities in Africa and also in Kenya. And I want you to imagine what kind of spaces these women have opened for themselves and in what ways they have done that. You know, although in theory the kind of grassroots organizations or voluntary organizations have been part of the lives of women, because if you look at some of the cultural expectations and experiences of women and the limited resources that they have had, women had always kind of found themselves coming together to help themselves. You know, for example, a women in a group in a village can be able to come together and they can go and help one of them to do the farming and so on. So these associations, you know, voluntary groups have been there as a way of women's ability to cope with their endeavors. So again, when you think about the democratization process and the using of the voluntary groups, we are talking about the fact that, you know, these things have already been there. What has happened in the recent past is that these groups have kind of become sensitized to what is happening politically, and therefore the women have used those avenues to be able to reach and to be able to try and see whether they can be able to participate in the political arena. You know, I'm going to give you a short background of Kenya as a country. We know very well, and I'm hoping that you know where Kenya is in Africa. But Kenya was colonized by the British, and Kenya got its independence in 1963. And from then on, you know, we see different kinds of changes, although, again, the more things have changed, the more things have remained the same. Now, what is happening here is that when we are thinking about understanding women and where they are coming from, we are looking at three distinct context through which you can try to understand women in Africa. First and foremost is the African tradition and cultural expectations, right? So we have that kind of context. You know, how does African culture define women, right? And what is the role of women within the African culture? So that is one of them. And the other context is the colonial context. How did the colonization affect, for example, the situation of women in Africa and in Kenya, for example? How was the colonization process, an impediment, for example, to the development of women? And when you look at the women also, you see that the fact that colonization also brought about changes that became kind of very disorienting for women, because, you know, they kind of brought in other values. You know, the dominant values. For example, the concept of the description of modernization, again, is the traditional values. You know, what are these, you know, modern values that the colonialists brought in terms of the concept of modernization? So we are looking at women also that have been also affected, within the context of colonization. And then after that, there was the period, the context of post-colonial. Now, with this, you know, countries became independent, Kenya became independent, and therefore, you know, they got their own government. What, again, was the issue of women in the post-colonial or after independence? So those three contexts, you know, actually impact on the lives of women in different ways. And I also don't want you to see them as separate. You know, they are all interconnected. It's a kind of intersection of all these things in the lives of women. And these are some of the things that we can be able to explore in order to understand the context and the struggles of women in Africa. Now, if you think about the African context, your African traditional context, you're talking about the fact that how did, for example, African system look at women? You know, women as mothers. You know, women as the people who are responsible for tilling the land and so on and so forth. And then you come also to the colonial context and say, okay, fine. When the colonialists came, they brought in the aspect of land problem. You know, so the land was not necessarily communally owned like it was within the African culture. The colonists kind of came and put a total different kinds of understanding of land and ownership. So the men were given the land, and the women were not necessarily, you know, seen as owners of the land. And yet the women, again, were the main people who work actually in this land. So again, you see the contradictions of African culture and colonialism. Now, when you think about the context, for example, of what women were defined as, mothers and so on, the colonialists brought the concept of modernization, modern mothers. And the mothers were seen not necessarily as part of the process of development. So in actual fact, when you look at the development process, as Sithina Boko has talked about, women were excluded because initially the colonial government did not see women as part and parcel of the development. And whatever they did in terms of their everyday lives, and remember they were the cultivators of land, they were they were feeding their families, that part of their activities was not necessarily included in the definition of what economics was. Economics was actually just, in terms of education, in terms of, whatever happened outside of the home. Now, the other thing also, when you think about the post-colonial governments, especially most of the African governments today, nothing much has changed. Most of them have actually kind of perpetuated the African traditions because most of the men, of course, are at Africa, are from the African tradition. And most of, again, the structure that the colonial government left are still intact. So what we are seeing apparently is that nothing much has changed for women, and women have still struggled to kind of find their space. So when you're talking about the fact that women are finding spaces for their development this time, then we must be able to look at what exactly are women doing. And when you look at the democratization process, it's very interesting because women kind of used the same kind of avenues that they had originally, that are given either by their position as women in some terms of gender. So women have used the organizations, for example, the grassroots organization as a venue, and also as an avenue for their participation. Now, how have they done this? In many, many ways. Now, one of the things that we can see, and I'm going to be very brief here, is how women sometimes come together, and instead of just looking at how they can be able to improve their lives and the lives of their children, they have used those organizations to to kind of bring about education. Sometimes we have to talk about basic education, or maybe hygiene. How do you keep your home clean, and so on and so forth. And out of that, then also they have tried to see how they can be able to come together and exchange ideas to see what they can do in terms of what Dr. Boko said about entrepreneurship. What can we do as women in the village, for example, to try and develop ways that we can be able to have money or resources to be able to take care of our families. Now, it is actually those kind of organizations that again have evolved in the recent time, and they have become not only apolitical, they have become political. Those organizations that started as apolitical, meaning that they were just there for self-help, women were organizing just to help themselves, get along with what they are doing, they have now evolved into what we can call political organizations. And again, you see, women were also, they knew that they had no opportunity to be able to be outspoken out there, but they are kind of organized around the powers and context within which they were able to play and to be able to function. So what is happening apparently is that you may not find a lot of women with placards and demonstrations going around saying this is what is happening with the government, but they become part of resistance even in when they do what they're supposed to do as women. And I want you to see the difference here, that sometimes when we think about resistance and we think about being activist, we most of the time think about, oh my goodness, you have to have your placard and you have to go out there and demonstrate. But African women are kind of revealing a different way of organizing and resisting by using the same kind of structures that they find themselves in, and they use that also as an avenue for activism. Now, one of the things that I would want to focus on is that women have organized again through these organizations, and also with the help of the now much more educated women in Africa. We know that many of the women in Africa have not had access to education, but we are also seeing also that those who have been lucky enough to get education, they are going back to try and help women in the rural area. Dr. Mboko has talked about the fact that there are women who are really encouraging women to have entrepreneurship education and so on, so that they can be able to organize their own activities. So one of those women, for example, that has really done marvelous in terms of organizing women at grassroots level was through the renowned Green Belt Movement. How many people have heard about the Green Belt Movement by Professor Wangari Maathai? So Professor Wangari Maathai is one of the first professors and women who have really gone to school. And what she did was to go back and organize women at grassroots level through the concept of helping women be able to safeguard the environment and be able to protect the environment so that they can be able to actually have their livelihood and sustain their livelihood from there. So she approached women by encouraging them to grow trees. So that, because you see now, when you think about the rural Kenya, you don't have gas, you don't have electricity. The source of heating, of course, is trees. And at one time there was this concern of the environment, depletion of trees in the environment. So Wangari saw this as an important way of getting the women to organize and to help them to plant trees. Now during the meetings of discussing how do we plant trees, what is the importance of trees, she actually used her own activism to kind of push, some issues about civil society. So the same kind of context within the home, within the village, she was actually helping women to really know about their rights. And for a long period of time, apparently, Greenbelt Movement worked with the support of the government, because the government was saying, after all, this is not a threat. She's just helping women. But eventually, they realized something else is happening here. And they realized, apparently, that women are becoming much more engaged, politically, because they started seeing environment, not just because that is what produces trees for the women to use to cook for their families, but they started connecting the lack of trees, the desertification, with the oppression which is actually being subjected by by the political system there, in terms of not protecting trees and so on. So there was a lot of now political things that were going on even within those very local meetings, and it's amazing because women started now becoming very much motivated to protect their environment, and they started now actually resisting the government. That is the time the government decided, oh my goodness, something is happening here, and they started now giving Professor Wangari a lot of problems. But even after that, still the movement had started. Women were encouraged. People knew, women knew what they needed to do, and the fact that they had the right to protect the environment for the sustainability of their lives and those of their children. So they started looking at development now from a totally different perspective. Now that also actually launched women into the political arena. So again, we are not finding a lot of women just shouting up there, or even sometimes even vying for political positions, because again there are so many barriers. But women are organizing and they are launching themselves into politics by deciding exactly who to vote. Again, the majority of women are voters. The majority of voters in Kenya and most of the African world are women. So they are saying, okay, fine, we may not be out there, but we are going to vote people who are going to be sensitive about our rights and the right to sustain those things, the environment that gives us sustainability. Now, women have not just organized around their grassroots organizations. Women, specific women also have taken they're challenged to do something about what the world is happening around. So one of them, of course, again, in her own right, is Wangari Maathai. But we have also seen other women who have also come based on, again, their definition and their roles as mothers. One of the renowned organization, or a group of women, not a bigger organization, but a group of women who came together and called themselves Mothers of Political Prisoners. So there was a time the Kenyan government was actually kind of arresting people and putting them into jail without necessarily charging them. And at one point, because of the same kind of sensitization about their political rights of women, these mothers, the mothers of the men who have been actually arrested and taken to jail, organized themselves and went to Nairobi and started to have what they call hunger strike. And they called themselves Mothers of Political Prisoners. And they stood there, defiant against the government to say, release our sons or charge them, right? And the mothers actually realized that they have a power as mothers. They may not have political power out there, but they realize that they can use the power that they have as mothers to push for political reform. So that is a very interesting group of women. And when these women were protesting, the government, of course, took time, and they were saying, okay, these are just women. They will get tired and go back home. But those women never went back home. They stayed in Nairobi, and they were literally, started becoming a sore to the government. And what happened one time, that the government, decided to throw them away and beat them up, and they sent the police. But what happened, apparently, is that these women decided that they are still going to use the traditional mandate that is given to mothers to fight for their rights. That was very, very interesting. What happens is that in an African culture, women, and especially when they become mothers, are given a different status. When you bear children, you acquire a different status. You become a mother, and therefore your body, to some extent, becomes sacred. So you know you don't expose parts of your body, and especially your the bad part of the body from the waist below, right? So understanding is that that part is very sacred, and it's not actually for anybody's eyes. Now these women decided that they are going to use the power that is given to them within the cultural context to really defy the government. And when the police came to beat them up, some of them stripped naked, okay? So they just removed their clothes. And do you know, that particular act made the rest of the country and even other parts of the world and other countries of the world to really focus on the government and say, you cannot be able to get the women to strip. That is even a curse. So the civil society in Kenya, the other parts of the world started now telling the government, you have to listen to what these women are doing, all right? And because of that, apparently the government released all the prisoners, you know, and that was really a very interesting catalyst to women's achievement of what they needed. And I'm going to stop very soon. The other one that I would want to focus on is also individual women that are fighting against the systems to be able to actually have their voices heard. One of them, which is also very renowned, is Wambui Otieno. Now, again, Wambui Otieno, I don't know how many of you know anything about the African kind of context, but Wambui Otieno's case against her clan, her tribe, her husband's tribe, actually. She was married, she was a Kikuyu married to a Luo, different cultural context, and then his husband dies. He was a very pronounced lawyer, a renowned lawyer in Kenya, and he dies, and the clan of the government of the husband decide, okay, you are a woman, you cannot bury your husband. Your husband belongs to us because we are the tribe where he came from. And of course, this also brought the issue of how much do women have in terms of their right to access their husband's estate and also to bury their husband. What is the strength of the marriage? What kind of power and privilege does marriage give to women? So Wambui Otieno's case again brought issues of looking at what are the disadvantages that sometimes women experience within the cultural aspect and also within the common law. And what happened is that, of course, Wambui Otieno was going to court against the clan, and again that brought a lot of issues in terms of the laws that we have. Even after independence, the post-colonial laws are very, very unfriendly to women, even when it comes to marriage and other property issues. So Wambui Otieno, of course, did not win. She was not given the mandate to bury her husband, but at least the court was able to give her administration of her husband's estate. Now, so that also showed that apparently that the laws that we have today are also not women-friendly, and sometimes there are also collision between the traditional laws and the post-colonial laws, again also being compounded by the laws that were introduced through the colonial time. Now, so with that very, very brief explanation of really what is happening in Africa today, how are women becoming part and parcel of the democratization process, and what are the struggles and hurdles that women have to go through, gives us at least a bit of hope. Even when you look at the number of women today in parliament, you may not necessarily be encouraged. There are not very many. In fact, I think in Kenya right now we have about 10 women. But that is also something, because there was one time that there are no women in parliament. So the battles are not won, but we are seeing also a new wave of women becoming engaged, not necessarily because they have education and everything, but I think because they feel very, very strongly that they can use their own women powers or status to be able to fight for their rights. Now, how far that is going to take the women, again, we still have to be able to see, because women can only do that much. If they still just have the power within the gender context, then again, we also see that you'll never have a breakthrough in terms of reaching those important positions where political and social and economic decisions are made, and women will always be at the subordinate of the society. So even as we are celebrating the use of women's own position at the moment, the cultural positions, we still believe that one day we need to break through that and be able to get the women into the political and public arena. And with that, I think I'm just going to stop there and probably give you a time maybe for questions. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you. Any questions? Yes. Sorry.
You both made reference to kind of, you both just used the term traditional, kind of traditional society in Kenya. Can you explain a little bit more?
You want me to? Okay, so traditional, I think, well, these terms sometimes are used interchangeably. You are talking about African cultural context or traditions, those African traditions. And the African tradition, of course, also is embraced by the African culture. Now, there's something I wanted to mention here that, you know, again, I don't think I want to stand and say there is only one African culture. We cannot have just one universal African culture. We have different cultures based on different kinds of geographical locations and different tribes. But you know, for the sake of my presentation today, I've used African culture or African traditions to actually allude to the fact that, you know, they have values, principles, and customs and regulations that govern how women and men function within the African culture. And those could be many. You know, it points to the definition of womanhood, for example, the role of women in society, the role of men in society. It also goes on to talk about how does the society, the African society, view land ownership, you know, and so on and so forth. And maybe Boko can add on to that.
Yeah, and in line with what Mumbi was saying, African cultural tradition is usually embodied in sayings, the way we do things, or, you know, our proverbs. Mm-hmm. For example, from a business context, we have statements that discourage women from making money. You know, we even have a statement in our own language describing anybody who likes money. So that is really contradictory to business, because mm-hmm. we say anybody who likes money is a prostitute. You are likened to a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And if we define success in our own context, you are not supposed to be ambitious if you are a woman. Mm-hmm. And in my studies of women entrepreneurs who have businesses that have lots of potential, it's sad to see that they settle for mediocre performance. Mm-hmm. They are not even aggressive in their marketing. To them, any positive result is good enough. And you can really see that cultural conflict. Mm-hmm. Because if you are ambitious, that's seen as a masculine trait. Mm-hmm. And that's unfeminine mm-hmm. to be ambitious. So we can go on, Jane, and talk about our African tradition.
And one of the example of people who have literally decided to break away from the African tradition is both of us. We are not supposed to be here. We are not even supposed to have been educated. We are not supposed even to have left our families in Kenya or Africa to be here. That is the total defiance.
That's taboo.
Of being African. So, you know, you are not supposed to even to aspire for education. In fact, you know, most of the African countries, they kind of like an education as a way of becoming masculine. So as a woman, when you are advancing education, they are saying, why do you want to be a man? So education is actually equated to being a man. So that those are some of the barriers. Any other question? Yes. Do you want to go? If I told you that, we'd be here the whole day until tomorrow. So can you just mention?
I think with me, it's really having to deal with perceptions. From the word go, I was born in one of the least developed rural areas in Zimbabwe. And going to school beyond fifth grade was a big challenge for women. So my dad had to fight cultural opposition. And I consider myself lucky because my dad was slightly disabled. So he himself had suffered being discriminated against. In fact, his mom hid him for the first 6 months, because in our culture, if you gave birth to a child who was disabled, that was considered taboo. So his own mom hid him until he was old enough, perhaps, to defy being killed. So I think that helped him sympathize with minorities, but he had to fight his own brothers, he had to fight society to keep allowing me to go to school. And, well, after dealing with that, in my own married life, I had to deal with, you know, challenges, you know, my in-laws expecting me to be like the rest of their daughters-in-law. I had to fight challenges with my husband's friends. He didn't mind. But like when I did my MBA, we were at the same university. I applied. He made copies of my own application forms. Because we had limited places, he was offered a place. And the university was kind enough to explain to me why they gave my husband a place. But when I eventually went, he was in second year and I was in first. And he continuously was challenged in front of his friends. Why are you allowing your wife to challenge you and so on? I mean, the examples are endless. Mm-hmm. Whatever you do is considered a challenge. You are not being feminine. And when I came to St. Cloud, I even had white professors, male, asking me why my husband allowed me to come here. So not necessarily in Africa, but I was asked that question several times. What are you doing here? Why did your husband allow you to be here? So it's...
I have a different... I don't know whether you have time, but I have a different story. Mine was not necessarily just from the people who are close to me, but also my age mates. You know, in Africa, you kind of grow with people who are born in your age. And they were saying, how, for goodness sake, can you even decide to go to America for an extended period of time? How can you even dare to go? How can you leave your family? How can you leave your husband? Who is going to cook for your husband? And then I also had challenges with my mother-in-law. They were saying, okay, fine, you married into this family, and one of the obligations is that you take care of my son. Who do you think is going to take care of my son? Yeah, so I had to deal with that too. So it's endless, you know, and people tend to think, you know, if you are really going to pursue education, then you must also have many other hidden agendas. Some of them, you know, might even accuse you of not being a good mother enough. I mean, how can you be a good mother if you are leaving your children for an extended period of time to go and pursue education? You know, and so those are things that you have to deal with. And then you come here, you come to a different context, you come to a different culture, and you can't even fit, and then you are still struggling to get used to snow, you know. Those are minute challenges. But what is interesting also, and I can close with this, is the idea that it's not just about choices. I mean, it's you have, as a woman who is wanting to break these barriers, it's not just about the choice. It's also about the consequences. Mm-hmm. So you choose to come here knowing that you are going to have very detrimental consequences. Some of the women who have pursued education, for example, have decided it's education, and then, of course, they know that they are going to lose their marriages, or, you know, their marriages are broken, or they'll never be accepted back into their society because they have, first and foremost, you know, defied the cultural expectations of women. So you make that decision, but you are very aware of the consequences. And one of the painful consequences is when you have to deal with the fact that you may never be able to fit in back into your culture and be accepted as somebody who has done something. You know, for me, I feel that there are times when I go back and people don't even see me as a good mother because I made that decision. And I have to feel sometimes, you know, when your own identity is questioned, that is the hardest thing to deal with. And those are the things that we deal with every day. That your own identity as an African Kikuyu woman is defined, is kind of challenged, and sometimes you might not be able to actually go back to that space. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is that you really have to establish a kind of a niche that you can be able to hold on to, say, okay, fine, even if I don't go back and fit into that culture, there's something that has given me an opportunity to redefine myself, and that is really the power that we hold on to. Yes.
Yes, I think with changes in society in general, we now have an appreciation of business women, but they also have to deal with societal challenges, even structural issues. If you are going to borrow money, for example, they want collateral security, and most of those assets are registered in your husband's name or your parents' names, and you need their authority. I dealt with a case of a woman who was running a very successful business. She needed to expand, and needed some money. And the bank said, you have a good project, but we're not lending you money until your husband becomes part of the operation. So the husband had to resign from work, come and spend time at the business without really being actively involved. And that really broke her heart. Mm-hmm. And the question of micro-lending is an issue because with mm-hmm. women who have identified business opportunities, you go to a bank, they will say, well, go and find some other women and come in as a group, then we can lend you money. And remember I said entrepreneurship is individualistic. Mm-hmm. You will not necessarily succeed as a group. Micro-lending is okay mm-hmm. for group lending and income-generating projects and even individual small loans. But for big business development, we need, you know, the mainstream lending mm-hmm. and a change in, you know, society's attitude towards women.
And if I can comment on that, you know, and I know people have, even multinational companies and outside people have come to kind of give opportunities for micro-lending. But when you give small little loans to women in the rural area, that is good or okay. But again, you're also tying them to the local kind of business. So you know, women will always be within the local business and not necessarily venture, as Mboko said, into those bigger businesses. So even when we are thinking of microfinancing and we are saying, okay, we are going to the rural areas, we are still perpetuating that kind of inequality in terms of just encouraging women to do those little businesses that might never even take them out into the public sector. Okay, one more question?
Does the IMF and the World Bank have any
effect on progress? Oh, my goodness. Can you repeat the question? Does the IMF and the World Bank have any effect or impact on...
Yeah.
If you talk to the women in Africa today, and especially those who are doing those kind of small businesses, fishing and everything else, they'll tell you that, as you know, when the World Bank and the IMF went to their country, the women became hungry, you know. So what you're saying apparently is that the structural adjustment programs that have been advocated by the World Bank through the IMF have hurt women who are struggling to come up with various kinds of businesses. Now, when the IMF and the World Bank and kind of talk about the fact that let's open up the trade, let's make the global economy the in thing, and let's you know kind of break down all the sovereign powers of nation states, right? And let's open up the market so that it's just anybody. Do you have something to sell? Sell it, you know, and so on. What has happened apparently is that even those things, for example, the lakes and the seas that were literally helping women, for example, in Africa, there are women in Kenya near the lake region who now cannot even be able to do anything because, you know, most of those areas that they were supposed to be fishing, and they were depending on the men to go and fish and bring the fish so that the women can be able to process the fish. Nothing is happening. We are having international fishing companies going out to fish. So you're talking about IMF and World Bank. They have actually kind of contributed to women in the third world, you know, slipping even deeper into poverty. Yeah. And we can talk about that, the complications of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.